Welcome, everyone. It's a wrap with Rap. I am your host, Ron Rappaport. I would like to thank all our listeners, our viewers, our supporters, and sponsors for making this podcast such a success. The podcast is being heard and seen in all 50 states, all provinces of Canada, and over 70 countries around the world. The podcast has been ranked by FeedSpot as one of the top 35 overcoming adversity podcasts on the web. Please visit our website, itsawrapwithrap.com, for all the episodes and previews of upcoming podcasts. This podcast features people who have overcome life's challenges and adversities, people who can inspire, motivate, and educate us on an assortment of topics. My guest today is Max Friedman. Max is an author, retired corporate communicator, memoir writer, and second-generation Holocaust survivor. His book titled Painful Joy, A Holocaust Family Memoir, is part memoir, part genealogical mystery, and part history, which explores the complicated relationship between two Holocaust survivors who experienced the painful joy of a love touched by death. Max shares how his mother and father survived the horror of the Holocaust, spending several years being imprisoned in concentration camps. During that time, his father's wife and two young daughters were murdered, and his mother's husband, parents, and most of her family were murdered as well. His parents met in Sweden after being liberated and fell in love, had two children, and eventually migrated to America. Max will explain to us the difficulty living in a family where both parents were haunted by the war and the atrocities they experienced and somehow managed to survive. Max will share how he and his sister grew up in a dysfunctional household where each of the four family members struggled to deal with the past by creating their own fantasies. Welcome, Max, to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. I read the book. I found it very well written. I found it thoughtful and was very insightful read into the long-term effects of the Holocaust, exposing the harmful effects of the experience on extended families and the resilience of the survivors. Now, I'd like you to start out by telling us a little bit about your mother and father before 1939, when Poland was invaded.
Sure. My parents both came from shtetls, small little villages in Poland. They came from large families. My mother, at one point, her family numbered 13 children.
Wow.
About eight of them survived. Very difficult time for poor Jews, and both of them came from poor Jewish families. My mother's father was a tailor. My father's father was a merchant, really just sort of working in the shtetl, selling farmers kitchen utensils and other equipment. And they lived a decent life for what it was, filled with anti-Semitism, but that was true for most of Poland's Jews. Poland actually had more Jews living there than any other country except for the United States, and depending on how you counted Jews, Russia. So they survived a lot, and my mother was a refugee from the First World War. My father's father died when he was very young, and he became the breadwinner in the family. So it was a tough life, but by 1939, my mother had gotten married to a luggage maker, and my father and lived in Krakow, and my father had married actually a wealthy Jewish woman whose parents and grandparents owned a number of shops in a small town. And he had a wife, and he had one child before the war and another child actually during the war.
Wow, okay. Now, first off, Max, what inspired you to write the book?
Well, I spend most of my life avoiding writing anything about my past and my parents' past, because I was living it, and that seemed to be more than enough. I gave it the office, and so I decided that I would rather not know more. And I understood from a very early age how painful it was for my parents to talk about their past.
Sure.
And my sister, who was a little older than me, and I spent a good part of our young lives trying to help them avoid the past. And so I naturally fell into that world as well, and knew my life wasn't normal and wanted to try to normalize it as best I could. But that didn't work out quite so well.
So you normalized it by kind of avoiding the subject.
We avoided the subject. My mother did spend a lot of time telling us about one aspect of her early life, which was the time she spent in the concentration camps. So I hate to say it, but I probably knew the words Mengele. I knew the words Plaschow and Auschwitz probably before I could even say my own name. My mother talked about them endlessly, but I didn't know anything else about her life. I didn't even understand why she talked so much, except that I think she had to in some way. My father never spoke about anything in his past until I was 20 years old.
Max, didn't your grandson have something to do with you writing this book? Didn't he
Yeah.
ask you a question or something?
Eventually, my grandson, we were very close to him, and when he was about 8 years old, he was having troubles in his life. He was concerned about lots of things, and I was trying to sort of make him feel that, things could be difficult even at a young age, but you get over it. And I started to talk about the idea of survivors, and just casually would talk about how my mother and my father lived through some very hard times, and we did with them, and they were survivors. And I was called a second generation survivor. And he was only 8 at the time. But then he asked me about surviving. And he said, "So, what does that mean? Does that mean that you were strong and that they were strong? And will I get some of that myself? Did you give some of that to my father, to my son, his
Right,
father?
right.
And then will I be able to be strong like a survivor as well?" And I said, "Well, I really don't know, because I don't really know much about my past." And that got me started. I had written or ghostwritten two memoirs for other people, and I knew more about their lives clearly than I knew about my own, and I was embarrassed. And it was 2016, and that began my journey to find out who they were and, in a sense, who I was.
So your grandson played a significant
Oh
role in you getting inspired.
And when I wrote the draft of the book, I showed it to my wife, who was following with me and was researching with me, to my two sons, and to my sister, and to Jacob. And they got the first manuscript, and I wanted them to see it and let me know what they thought.
Yeah, had he never asked you that question, who knows? We might not even be talking right now.
We might not, and I might still be wandering around in my
Now,
craziness.
Max, tell us about the research that you did to find out all the information that you wrote about, and did you receive any help doing it? I understand the research took you about 5 years. Is that correct?
It took 5 years. It was very difficult because obviously a lot of the information was destroyed as the records were destroyed. Young Jews in Poland, there were very few civil records, and most things were kept in synagogues, and those kind of synagogues were burnt and destroyed, and the records were taken. And so it was very difficult to begin. I was fortunate enough to have mentioned it to a friend of mine that I was thinking about doing this, and he said, "I had just come back from a high school reunion, and I saw a friend who I hadn't seen for years, and he said that his son was working at a Holocaust study center in Germany, and maybe he could advise you." And I got in touch with him, this lovely man, and not Jewish, Austrian actually, and had devoted his life to learning about the Holocaust, studying it, being an academic. And so he gave me a great many leads, and I followed those leads, and I followed the breadcrumbs that were left in lots of different places. And I learned a lot. I made a list one day of how many things surprised me. And there were over 50 very significant things that sort of left me breathless.
Wow.
And it took 5 years to get through that, visiting Poland, visiting Israel, visiting Germany, visiting Sweden, where we were born. And I learned a lot. I met a few people who actually, one person who actually knew my mother and father and us in Sweden. We didn't know her until we found her. And I met a niece of my father's from his first marriage in Israel, who was actually working as an historian at Yad Vashem. So things came together, and there were extraordinarily many emotional moments as I sort of followed their footsteps in their lives.
What stands out? You said you were surprised there were like 50 things on the list,
Well, I
but
was
what
surprised.
stands out the most?
Well, I was surprised by the story, the information that I finally got from them, or my mother and father. As I said, my father only spoke to me about his past for 20 minutes, and he told me the story of the last time he saw his wife and children.
Yeah.
And it was a very sad story, and it's in the book. And what I discovered was that it wasn't quite true. My mother had told us for years that she had married a dance instructor who had this wonderful and very prosperous dance studio in Krakow, and she worked for him, and they made thousands of dollars and all of this. And then when after she met my father, she was disappointed that, he really, no, we never made, we were poor. And she had left this wonderful life, and unfortunately a life that was changed forever because of the Holocaust. And it turned out that virtually nothing that she told us was true.
Wow.
So those were two sort of remarkable experiences. And more remarkable was me coming to understand why they told us those stories and why that helped them survive, I think.
What roadblocks did you encounter doing the research?
Well, sometimes you still sort of felt that anti-Semitism hadn't really left Poland all
Right.
that much. We would go to some archives, and we were treated quite nicely. We would go to others, and we were treated poorly, is a nice way of putting it,
Okay.
disrespectfully. They knew fairly quickly we were Jews because we one of the people that helped us was a guy who worked in Warsaw for a Jewish historical institute, but he spoke Polish. He had moved from Israel to Warsaw, and so he was our interpreter. And so it was clear that we were Jewish, the questions that we asked, and sometimes that was not helpful, but we managed to find an awful lot. And it felt good to really begin to understand who my parents were and really the kinds of things that they went through before the Holocaust and during those years.
Well, that leads up to my next question. I wanted you to tell us the experiences your mother and father endured from 39 to 45 as captives, starting with your mother first. And, I don't want to set off any triggers or anything like that, but, whatever you want to tell us, just go ahead and you'll feel comfortable
Sure.
telling
My
us.
mother, the interesting thing about my mother's story is that for those people who are listening or watching, who have seen Schindler's List, Steven Spielberg. In fact, one of the surprising things about that is that Spielberg shot the Krakow ghetto scenes in the tenement that my mother lived in for 25 years. And I only discovered that when I was Googling the address, because we were going to go visit every address that I could find for my parents when they were younger. And in Google, I put Josepha 12 in Krakow, and I get this long thing about Steven Spielberg. And so it turned out that she lived in Krakow for 25 years with her husband, who, as I said, was not a dance studio entrepreneur, but in fact made luggage in a luggage store. And she survived the Krakow ghetto. She then survived Plaszow, where again, if people watched Schindler's List, you would see Ralph Fiennes played Amon Göth, and Amon Göth was called the butcher of Plaszow, and he was the guy. And my mother would tell us these stories. He was the guy who would, at breakfast, randomly shoot people, inmates who were just walking the yard. And my mother would tell us these stories, and we didn't believe anything until we saw Schindler's List. And suddenly, her story was Schindler's List without being a Schindler Jew, which meant that she wasn't saved. So she went through the Krakow Plaszow, the Krakow ghetto, and then Auschwitz. And after Auschwitz, Bergen-Belsen. And that's where she ended the war, in Bergen-Belsen. And she managed to save her sister. She was in the selection at Auschwitz. Her sister was older and I think heavier. And she saw her being taken to one side, and she was taken to the other side. And the side where my mother's sister was taken to had old people and children, and they were going to the gas chambers. And she knew something was wrong. She was very intuitive, if crazy. And she pulled her across bravely, doing that as they set the guard, the dogs on them. And that woman, my aunt, stayed with her their entire lives,
She
but
just saved her life.
saved her life. Yes.
Over 20,000 households each month make the choice to join Switch to the Box shopping club. They realize being their own health advocate and voting with their dollars becomes their voice. An estimated 133 million Americans, nearly half of the population, suffer from at least one chronic illness, such as hypertension, heart disease, and arthritis. That figure is 15 million higher than just a decade ago, and by 2030, this number is expected to reach 170 million. Studies show that one in every three people will have cancer in their lifetime. We are being led down a path of deception through false advertising and subpar testing of the products we use. Lawsuits are mounting against huge corporations for products contaminated with dangerous amounts of cancer-causing chemicals, products labeled natural actually containing synthetic ingredients, fraudulent labeling of products. Sunscreens being recalled after an internal testing shows low levels of benzene, a carcinogen in the product. According to the Consumer Reports National Research Center, 78% of Americans prefer to purchase products manufactured in the United States. Great news! Switch to the Box represents a North American manufacturer located in the United States, doing business since 1985, that has met the standard of formulating, manufacturing, and packaging products that are safe, free of harmful chemicals and toxins, are effective, competitively priced, offering outstanding customer service, privately owned and patriot-driven. You will find Switch to the Box products to be more effective than national brand products, making laundry rooms, living rooms, bedrooms, kitchens, nurseries, and bathrooms safer and more enjoyable. Their products feature natural ingredients like citric acid to remove hard water stains, enzymes to clean dishes, and biodegradable ingredients to gently remove tough stains from laundry. Every nutrition, personal care, home cleaning, and cosmetic product has been developed and manufactured to stand out from the competition. Each of their over 400 products is superior in a very clear and relevant way. Become a member today. There is no added expense to your budget by joining, as you are already someone else's customer. Click the link in the podcast notes to obtain information on joining and a full description of the program and all the benefits. Now, back to the podcast.
And they had a difficult relationship even then, but she did, and she... So Auschwitz was horrific. My mother was in Bergen-Belsen, actually, when Anne Frank and her sister were there. And they all suffered from typhus. And Anne Frank and her sister actually died from typhus. And then she was liberated, and she was taken by the Swedes, the Swedish Red Cross, to Sweden to recuperate. She was terribly malnourished. And psychologically, she was destroyed. That was my mother.
Yeah.
And she had five brothers, and they and all their families were transported out and killed. Her husband was killed in Buchenwald. My aunt, her daughter and husband were murdered as well. So it was... she had no one. She had no one at all. My father met her in Sweden. He had started very early in slave labor camps. So he was in three slave labor camps before being sent to concentration camps. And he spent almost the entire war in one camp or another. So amazingly, he survived five of these camps. And he survived a death march from the camp that he was in Germany, and he ended up in Bergen-Belsen as well. And he ended up taken by the Swedish Red Cross to Sweden also to recuperate. And they met at one of the camps that were set up by the Swedes for these refugees. And the best thing about the book to me and finding things out was that that they loved each other, because in fact for most of their life they just fought and screamed at the world and screamed at each other, because that these are the only people that they had. But I found love letters that my father had written about meeting this woman and who became my mother. And so that brought me joy as well, because to see that they could survive, and that's where Painful Joy, the title of the book, came from, because I had read that there was a poet in the Middle Ages who had written a poem about what happens to love when it's touched by death. And as soon as I saw that, and I saw the title of the poem, I said, that has to be the title of my book.
Sure. Now, I don't know, do you have a copy of the book there by chance?
Yeah, I do have it.
Because I noticed on the cover, there's a picture of your parents. Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, I noticed on the cover, if you want to show people the cover. Yeah, there's a picture of your parents on a motorcycle.
Can you imagine that?
So do you know anything about that? Was that their motorcycle?
Well, honestly, I think it was staged. But it was, staged by them in Halmstadt, which is where I was born and where they met, or where they lived, and where my sister and I were born. But this was a picture that was taken just 6 months after they had been liberated from Bergen-Belsen. And it was 6 months before they were married. So they were still courting. And this was the best clothes that they had. Actually, this is my father's only suit. It was given to him by the Swedish Red Cross. And in whatever pictures I have from Sweden, he's wearing that suit, except for when he was working in a shoe factory. And this was a wonderful picture to have discovered, because it again showed me what they wanted to become, in a sense. This was not their world, motorcycles or even being dressed up or being in Sweden for that matter. But it showed me that they were trying so hard to start again. And I didn't mention but my father did have these two little girls. And the story that he told me about the last time he saw his wife and two little girls. And he told me that when he didn't know what happened to them, that they were hiding out, and then they were discovered and they were taken away. And on the death march to Bergen-Belsen, he meets somebody from his hometown who tells him that he saw my father's wife and two children at Auschwitz at the ramp, train ramp, and the children had been taken away from their mother. And the mother, he said, ran over and said, "I go wherever they go." And so that's when my father discovered that they had been actually murdered. And when I even found out the names of these two little girls, Ada and Feigle, suddenly they became real. And that got me to thinking about the book more seriously, in that this is a story about two real people who had a life before, who had families before, and then had nothing. And when you meet them, you meet them as sort of a nameless, faceless people, another survivor, one of not the 6 million who died, but the few hundred thousand who didn't. And you get to know them. And that became the point of the book, is Painful Joy was about meeting these people and feeling something for them. And that, I thought, would be a way of restoring their humanity.
I want to move on. Your family emigrates to the U.S. in 1952. Now, how did that come about, and what was the tra that transition like for them and you and your sister?
Well, my father wanted to go to the U.S. As soon as he got out of Bergen-Belsen. He had some first cousins who had left Poland in the 1920s and moved to the United States because there were pogroms going on in Poland in the 20s, and they had had enough. And so they left. And so he had been communicating with them from Sweden to see if there was a way for them to bring us over. America was not interested in taking any of the refugees from the camps for the first few years after the war. So nobody from the camps got to the United States. They first opened up and changed the quota system a bit in 1948. And my father tried, but he couldn't get an appointment at the consulate and whatever. So it took 7 years to get to the United States, and we were brought over by a refugee agency on a Swedish ocean liner in January, and they found us a place to live in Coney Island, and that's where we grew up.
All right. Now, you are now in America growing up. What was you and your sister Rachel lives like under the parenting of your mother and father, who obviously suffered long-term effects? I guess they call it survivor or concentration camp syndrome, from their war years of survivorship. In other words, tell us about the family dynamics growing up. What were the family dynamics like?
We lived in Coney Island, which, as some of your your listeners and viewers would know, was a big amusement park area.
Yeah. Right by the
Well,
ocean, right?
yeah, we lived right by the ocean. We lived in this tiny two-room apartment, looking out at a lovely alley. But we were not allowed to go on any rides. My parents were afraid of everything and of everyone. Suspicious. My mother was paranoid, if you could, perhaps with good reason, but
Yeah.
paranoid
I mean,
nevertheless.
they have good reason to be.
Right. But so we were, and they were very afraid of losing us or us being hurt or anything like that. So it was a tough time because we couldn't go on anything. We would sit, we didn't want to be in our apartment in particular. My father sent us to yeshiva. It was probably the poorest and worst yeshiva that one could imagine. And I finally told my father that the rabbi had hit me when I was in fifth grade there, which wasn't true, but I told him that, and he immediately took us out of yeshiva and we went into public school. But the sad part was that they had nightmares. They suffered from PTSD, as you would call it now.
Yeah.
So we would be waking them up a lot. We would try to have them avoid learning anything more about concentration camps or about wartime things. My mother tried to sort of live her life through my sister, which was not a good thing, and she made up this story about what her life was like, and she wanted my sister to be like she would have become. And that was very trying for my sister. I just wanted to disappear. When I was 7 years old, I started taking the subway into Manhattan, and I would dress up as though I were an adult, if one could believe that, because I was a shrimp. Not that I'm any much taller now, but I had a fantasy life of my own. I would carry a manila envelope because that was the closest I could get to a briefcase. I would put on a little bow tie, and my father would be sleeping because it was the Sabbath, and so we would go to synagogue in the morning, and then he went to sleep, and my sister and my mother would go out, and I would take the subway. And I would go into the city and I would ride up and down elevators as though I were an adult, living a life of an office worker. So it was very strange, very, very strange. And but they were sad people. I would go with them sometimes to the United Restitution, which was the people who would give reparations. And you'd have to show up once a year. I mean, the reparations were $45 a month for
Wow,
each of them
not much.
when we first started. And then the mark got better, so they got more money, but they didn't actually get more money. They just it came up in value just to see if they were alive. So I would sometimes translate for them, and they would tell me in Yiddish what they wanted to say, and I would tell them in English. I understood Yiddish, but I was so not wanting to be in their lives at a certain level. I refused to learn to speak Yiddish. I would understand it, and I would only speak to them in English. But I mean, a life where the kids become, somebody call people like us, child parents.
Yeah.
Because we were taking care of them as much or more than they were taking care of us.
So there was some, you would it be fair to say there was some you being ashamed of them a little bit?
I was not happy to be known as a Jew. So when the Italian kids and the Avenue X boys went after us, it was not a so I tried to hide that. I didn't invite our friends over to our apartment, as it was sort of a shabby place. We had old furniture. Over time, I grew up and I matured, and I just felt that I became to understand, certainly,
Right.
what happened to them
Right.
and how that affected them.
And they were
And
doing
then,
the best they could
oh yeah,
with what they
always.
had. But
Yeah, I mean
when you're young like that, you
we never expected, and my sister was is and was wonderful with them.
Let's break away for a moment to let me tell you about a book our podcast supporter, Rissa August, has written titled The Road Unpaved, Border to Border with a Brain Tumor and a Bite, which gives the reader an honest, intimate look at a Herculean physical effort while revealing a very personal struggle with a brutal disease. Read and write along with Rissa as she relates her incredible experiences with acromegaly, a rare condition where the body produces too much growth hormone, causing body tissues and bones to grow more quickly, leading to a wide range of devastating and damaging symptoms. Follow her successful, inspiring challenge to cycle the Pacific Coast Highway from north to south, which is 1,845 miles long from Canada to Mexico. The old Rissa could have done the ride in her sleep, but for the new Rissa, trapped in a body that no longer feels like her own and stuck in the company of her brain tumor named Bubba, the ride becomes a challenge unlike she has ever had to face. The book is a testament to the power of the human spirit. Rissa shares her honest account of being diagnosed with a brain tumor and how she found meaning, purpose, and joy in uncertainty. Filled with passion and exuding deep insight, Rissa takes the reader on an adventure of the soul. You will be captivated as Rissa goes against all odds and digs deep within herself. The reader also pedals along on a profound journey of adversity. Rissa masterfully weaves together both humor and brutal honesty to provide a window into the patient experiencing of one suffering from a significant medical condition. It is a heart-wrenching yet refreshing account of finding the courage to break down barriers and to embrace and live one's best life. As Rissa pedals through rain, pain, and the ghosts of her memories, she wonders if the woman she once was will ever return, or whether the new woman rising up in her place just might be the person she was meant to be all along. Every once in a while, a person and a book comes across your path that makes you stop and realize just how precious life is, and that we should seize every single opportunity and make the most of every moment we have been given. Rissa is one such person, and her incredible, uplifting, and inspiring story will leave a lasting imprint on your heart and mind. In this wonderful book, I have no doubt that you will vow every day to be more like Rissa in your outlook and actions. The book is available in paperback, audio, Audible, and Kindle format from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Rakuten, Bookshop, and Goodreads. Rissa's website, www.rissaaugust.com, lists all your purchasing options and dates of book signings. The book information will be listed in the podcast notes.
And we just said it's easier to do whatever they wanted than to argue with them. So we just did whatever they wanted. I mean, when I went to college, I would come home on the weekends, and I would go to synagogue with my father because that was the only time where he seemed to be relaxed and happy. And so, no big deal.
So you knew your home life was not normal compared to your friends. Did Max, did you confide in anyone about your situation? And was counseling offered to your family at all?
No, they never, no. They never got any help for their mental problems. And for me, I didn't really think of myself as a survivor until I was working, and I was went to some management retreat, and there were industrial psychiatrists who were there. We were supposed to bring with us a problem from our workplace, and the problem I had was my boss, who was a bully, and these days would have been fired, but back then not, because he was a good worker. And I had described him at the session, and I had told the psychiatrist a little bit about myself, and he was the first one to sort of say, well, your parents were survivors, and you've spent a good part of your life trying to survive. And here you are still trying to survive a bully of some sort instead of leaving. He said your parents couldn't leave, but you can. And so I would urge you to quit and go somewhere else where they appreciate you. And in fact, as a survivor, I didn't leave. I had two kids. I had a job that paid well. And I said, I'm going to stick with it. And it was not probably the best decision I ever made, but there was one that I think would be typical of a survivor.
Yeah, for sure. Tell us about your parents' later years and about you and your sister's lives as you approached adulthood and beyond.
Yeah, so my parents, my father worked till he was 65. My mother was a homemaker. She never worked. They lived a quiet life, except they argued with each other constantly, mostly about money, and the fact that my father was not ambitious, and which really to me was just that he so much wanted. I think he spent a good part of his young life taking risks, particularly in the camps, taking great risks to survive. And he wanted to take no more risks with himself or with his children. And so he was not ambitious. He was happy to whatever job he had, and he had the same job from the time that we came to the United States till the time he retired. And my mother always was very, very difficult about all that. In any case, ultimately, my father had Alzheimer's disease, and so he and my mother moved down to my sister, who had left New York and married and had children and lived in Mobile, Alabama, of all places. And my parents moved to Mobile, Alabama, of all
That
places.
must have been quite a culture
And so,
shock coming from New York.
right. And so what my mother did was, the survivor that she remained, she became the celebrity Holocaust survivor in Mobile, Alabama. And so every year they lived there for, I guess, 7 years, the last 7 years of their lives. And so every year some radios or television station would call them up and say, "It's a Holocaust Remembrance Day. Tell us." And she would be delighted to go over Mengele and Auschwitz and everything else. We have clips from newspapers of all that. And actually, I was down in Mobile talking to a group of college students about my parents just a month ago, talking about the Holocaust. And it was a wonderful experience, actually, too, because very few people who were Jewish, but people who were interested and kids who were interested, which I found even better.
So you're doing some you're out there doing some advocacy work beyond the
Yeah,
book.
I'm trying. I'm trying to again continue to find a way to get people to empathize with people who they may not have ever known or would never have known,
Right.
particularly these days where everything is so fraught.
Did you eventually figure out how to
Answer.
grandson's question about survivorship?
Yeah, I said that. And he came with us actually to Israel and to Yad Vashem and all of that, and I was able to tell him how surviving is not easy, and it's not always it's the only thing you have, and you do the best you can, and if you keep yourself strong and keep thinking about today and not that much about tomorrow, I think you have a chance. And you don't look back and you don't look forward. I think it, for anybody who were in my parents' shoes, and I don't think I would have been able to have survived what they did, I think you have to live in the moment and do what you can. And I was proud of my father because I met a man who was in the camps with my father. And the only thing he would ever say to me, and he was living in Venezuela, and he would visit my father every few years with his family. And he said, "This man saved my life many times." And he never told me how. And I asked his daughter, who I found in researching the book, and she said, "He never talked about it except to tell me that your father saved his life many times." And that was a wonderful
Yeah, must have
thing
made you feel
to
real good.
leave. And that was a legacy that I'll hold dear all the time.
Sure. Max, how did you feel when the book was finally published? And after learning so much after writing this memoir, what stands out the most?
Well, I mean, the sad part is that I never asked them all the questions I asked everybody else. So I don't know what they would have told me if I really delved and had like a real sort of sit down interview with
Yeah.
them, which is what I would do with for the rest of my life and in my professional life. But I just felt that I was giving them something that I couldn't give them in when they were alive. I could help people honor them, help people look at them as not some poor, misbegotten, sad people, which they also were, but actually as heroes, as people who stood not up against the Nazis, but managed to survive whatever came to them, and they started again, and to be able to start again, and to have children and grandchildren, and a life, even with all the memories, and I saw how they had to tell stories to themselves that maybe were not true or not quite accurate. But they had to do that because the memories that they had were not memories that they wanted to keep. So they had to create new memories for themselves that they could hold on to that would not necessarily give them a nightmare.
Sure. And one of the big themes of the podcast is we don't ever want our people going through adversities to quit. And they never quit. They
No,
kept going.
no.
The quitting was not an option for them.
No,
And I'm
no.
sure it would have been much easier to quit.
Oh yeah. I mean, the in when I talk about it, and people ask me, so what did you learn in your life? And I learned to never give up.
Right.
No matter what. I mean, on the smallest things, I'm quite annoying, I think,
Yeah.
and a pain,
Keep trying.
but I persevere, and I learned that persevering, can be hard. It can be painful, actually, but it's the it can also make you feel that you've done everything you could, and there aren't regrets, and I think that's important as you get older.
Now there are people out there. There are Holocaust deniers out there, and there's people out there that are not educated on this subject. What are your thoughts about that to improve that situation?
Yeah, I mean the Holocaust survivor denier stuff and the anti-Semitism that we see is just—I mean, it's disgusting, nauseating, ludicrous. It's hard to imagine, but people are not educated. I mean, I think it is certainly true that there are some states in the United States where Holocaust curricula are in fact required. But there are also places where it's not. In Europe, the same is true. My book is published by a Dutch publisher, Amsterdam Publishers, and in Holland, where more Jews, I mean, in terms of percentages, were actually killed, murdered, than in most of the other countries as a proportion of population and of the Jewish population. The surveys show that Holocaust denial is quite common, and Holocaust ignorance is even more common. And I think the joy I got when I got to Mobile was actually talking to students who were interested in the Holocaust, who were doing projects about the Holocaust. They were not Jewish, none of them was Jewish, but they had heard about it and they wanted to know what the truth was. And I think truth is now something that we don't we say, well, there are many truths. Well, there are not many truths. There is a truth, and then there's everything else.
Right.
If we don't start telling ourselves the truth or hearing the truth, we'll someday be in a similar situation, and we just won't even know how to navigate through that. My parents, when they were younger, when the Nazis came to their doors, they didn't know what to expect. They didn't imagine that this would ever happen, even with years of anti-Semitism behind them. So here we are, a nation, a well-educated nation in theory, that where kids don't know much of anything about any of this. And these books, I think, are still important, and it's up to the second generation, people like me and my sister, to carry the story forward, because the survivors themselves are pretty much all gone.
Sure. How can people contact you, Max, and where can they find the book Painful Joy?
Sure. Amazon, where you can find everything else
Right.
in life. But Amazon is the easiest. There are some libraries that now have it, Barnes and Noble, and so you can get it that way. You can go to my website. I actually created a website called maxfriedman.net. A catchy title, I'm sure, but nevertheless, www.maxfriedman.net.
Okay.
And you can find more sources for where the book is, and you can find more information about the book, including excerpts.
Max, you lived and survived through a lot. What words of advice do you have for people out there to overcome their adversities, whatever they might be, and live a happy life?
I think what I would reiterate the idea of, first, of course, never giving up, never saying that this is too much. There is always some hope somewhere. You just have to find it, and you have to keep that close to you. You have to make a life for yourself. It's no one's going to do it for you. And I think that's what the survivors learned, that they had to live in the moment, not look back, and look ahead, because you're creating your own future. And when I sign the book, I always sign, never give in, never forget, and never ever give up.
Awesome. Awesome. I want to thank you, Max, for coming on the podcast and sharing your story. I highly recommend people out there to read the book, educate yourself on the topic so the world will never experience something like this again. And once again, Max, thank you for making yourself vulnerable. Thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing your time with us.
Great. I appreciate it very much. And if you go to that website, you can actually send me notes, and I'm happy to respond.
Will do, and I will put all that information will be in the podcast notes. Comments and suggestions for the podcast, you can email me at itsawrapwithrap@gmail.com. Our Facebook group, which is growing, it's in the thousands. It's a Wrap with Rap. Instagram, it's a Wrap with Rap podcast. We're on Twitter or X, which is at Rapper, WRAPPER 130. Our website is itsawrapwithrap.com, and our YouTube channel is It's a Wrap with Rap, the podcast uncut. I want to thank everyone for listening. Please stay safe. And for now, it's a wrap. This podcast is being brought to you in part by the veteran-founded Hero Soap Company, located in Phoenix, Arizona. In today's environment, we must be aware of the products we apply to our skin. As a two-time cancer survivor, I cannot afford to take chances, and I use these products myself. The soaps will leave you feeling clean and refreshed. All the products made by the Hero Soap Company are made in the United States with the highest quality ingredients sourced from companies in the United States whenever possible. The products are made in small batches to ensure high quality and contain premium essential oils and fragrance. All Hero soaps are created without synthetic colorants, parabens, and sulfates that are irritating to the eyes, skin, mouth, and lungs, and are cruelty-free, meaning these products are not tested on animals. Each 5-ounce bar of soap is handmade in Phoenix, Arizona, and the body wash is available in 8 ounces with such refreshing scents as the woods, tea tree, lavender, the fields, bourbon, lime, the pines, and Arctic. You will absolutely love this soap. Please also check out their gear for sale. All the products are reasonably priced. Being veteran-founded, the company understands the dedication and sacrifice that each family makes to serve their country. A portion of sales is donated back to charities that are focused on helping veterans and our first responders. Over 1,200 bars have been sent to our deployed troops. Please check out their website, HeroSoapCompany.com, for pricing and a detailed description of all the products. When ordering, use the code RAP for a 10% discount. The company information will be listed in the podcast notes and featured on the podcast website, Facebook group, page, and the podcast Instagram.